Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery. With your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Is
6.5
FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren. Mr. Dave Martino is fighting his way through the smoke.
Smoke. Oh,
oh, you big sissy.
Canadian smoke.
Big sissy. You know, you're blaming everything on Canada. Everything. You
That's
know,
right.
I'm Canadian, and they blame everything on me. They call me a leftist, a socialist. My God. Tucker's going to be blaming this on me like he did the last thing.
It's all your fault, Al.
Yeah. Tucker
all
on
your fault.
Tucker on Twitter is going to be talking about me.
That's right.
He won't. I'm too small for that. Yeah. He's got a shorter time span. So, anyway. Well, so after the smoke, we're going to be talking about smoke. No, we're going to be talking about a new book called Death's Pale Flags. We have the author here, and he's going to tell us all sorts of secrets. So, Mr. Gary Simmons, thank you for being here.
Thank you so very much for having me.
Well, so Gary, I have to say, I really noticed that you are really a brain surgeon, too, aren't you?
Yes, I suppose so.
No, this is a medical thriller, and it involves a brain surgeon, but that's also what you did for a living, correct?
That is correct.
So is writing harder than brain surgery?
Well, that's an interesting question. I used to say, or I still say, I think you can basically teach anybody brain surgery if you have enough time. It's more a time investment and a work investment than anything else. Writing isn't easy, at least decent writing. And I'm not even sure if I can be, considered guilty of decent writing, but I do know I've rewritten what I've written a billion times. I guess you only get one shot at it with each patient in brain surgery.
Yeah. It's not like you get to redo it. I guess. I don't know.
Every once in a while.
Yeah. Now, I noticed in your earlier books, you were talking about, you know, the range of topics of, you know, burnout and education and ethics, neurosurgery, neuroscience, healthcare, like all these things were in one. And now you've gone into a medical thriller or ghost thriller, as it's called. Why the change?
Well, the original books really all circled around the concept, the world of burnout. Because I was noticing a lot of burnout around me, and I'd probably be disingenuous to say I didn't notice it within me. But anyway, there's plenty of burnout to be had out in the medical world. And we studied it for quite a while and wrote several books on it. And it does creep into the novel. But really what I wanted to do with the novel throughout my career, I kept thinking, geez, people would probably like to know more about what's going on here, you know, behind the doors in the actual operating rooms, what we actually do in our world. And there's actually a couple of, or a few, pretty decent books about, neurosurgery and brain surgery out there, but they're all nonfiction, and they kind of get a little bit didactic. If I had any criticism, they're actually very good books, but I thought it might be much more immersive if I actually weaved it into a novel, into a fictional story. I thought it might actually put the reader right there in the operating room, holding the scalpel or the high speed drill and popping off the skull and seeing what's underneath it. So I think that was what really started to drive me into a fictional work, is really wanting to put the reader right there. And it was, I couldn't escape from my previous burnout theme. So that crept its way in there for sure.
Well, what interested you in doing a supernatural or a ghost thriller, as opposed to doing maybe like a straight medical thriller?
I think tales of ghosts are woven into my being. My mother, my grandmother were off the boat Scottish, and I think at least half the British population is pretty convinced of the existence of ghosts. So certainly my mother and grandmother had many stories of their own interactions with the paranormal. And so it was just kind of in me, and I enjoyed reading ghost stories throughout my growing up. And even still, my wheels began turning about the fact that my world was constantly tiptoeing the line between life and death. I used the analogy of a bridge between the world of the living and the world of the dead. And I thought it, you know, if anybody is going to be paid a visit by the dead, it might be somebody who's always near that bridge, always tiptoeing that line. And I think certainly my field is one where you just, you're there all the time. And I guess that's how things started to fall into place. And I thought it would be interesting. Neurosurgery is so high tech, so science oriented, so kind of matter of fact, to kind of weave that together with a much more fantastical story.
So did you draw from any experience, or did you have any experiences that would be considered paranormal in an operating room or in a medical setting?
Me personally, honestly, no. Other than, you know, you see your share of witness your share of miracles, you witness your share of, you know, great emotional situations and all. But I'm afraid I never experienced being tapped on the shoulder by the ghost of neurosurgeons past.
Or neurosurgeons future.
Right. That would even be more scary, I think.
Yeah. Well, I see. There you go. Now you got a sequel.
There you go.
How do you develop a story like this? Like, where do you draw from then? Obviously, the medical part and the surgery part and the person, your character, the brain surgeon, is something you can relate to and you've had experience with. But when you have the situation of seeing ghosts and spirits that you didn't, so where does that come from?
Yeah, I think some of it goes back to that Scottish upbringing. I think there were certain stories that I had heard as a child that I may have pulled pieces of into there. I wanted the reader to be able to consider it. I wanted a mystery, if you will, as to whether what the protagonist was experiencing was real or was a figment of his imagination. Was he going insane? So I that was part of it. And I began thinking as well, what really is more scary, the paranormal of these ghosts, or really the normal? So I tried to juxtapose each sighting with with some fairly horrible stuff that was occurring in the hospital.
You want to tell us any hospital names that you know? So your main character, Ryan Renan, who is he, and how did you create that character? Is that really you, or is it a part of you?
Yeah, I think he's a much better person than I am. Part of his flaw is that he's so deeply invested that he loses track on everything else. And the things that make his life worth living, that's his family and his friends who work real hard to pull him back from the edge, because whether the ghosts are real or not, he's definitely losing it. And he's due for a real crash. How did I create his being? Are there elements of me in there? Of course, probably the less savory ones. But I've met, so many tremendous people in medicine through the years that I think I pulled pieces out of many. I started my medical career in the Army. I was trained at Walter Reed and was a faculty at Walter Reed. And boy, just some of the people that I knew there were just such outstanding individuals that I definitely wanted pieces of them in there, with just that level of dedication and caring. I think it's definitely an amalgam. And if there are pieces that are particularly unsavory, those are probably my pieces. And if there are pieces that are fairly heroic and unselfish, I think those are some of my Walter Reed buddies.
Well, I'm wondering how you create your dialogue. I've heard that 20 to like 50% of people actually don't have an inner monologue and they can't hear their thoughts. So I get curious as to when you're creating dialogue, can you hear your characters or do you find some other way to express what they want to express through dialogue?
That's a great question. It's an interesting question. In the two parts, one is, I'm surprised that people say they don't have inner dialogue. I thought we all did.
I did too.
I work with med students and pre-meds a lot. And, I always ask them that question. How is your inner dialogue? What kind of things does your inner dialogue say to you? I know my personal one, my own inner dialogue, is a prick and is constantly saying nasty things to me and filling me with all sorts of levels of guilt. Therefore, for the dialogue, I can tell you, it all played out in my mind. Now, some of it, frankly, I just stole from my own life. I mean, dialogue within the operating room was pretty easy to recreate. And I frankly toned it down a fair amount. One of the early readers of the book, said, do you guys really swear that much? And I was like, oh man, it's worse than you think. And I even toned it down further after, that feedback. But yeah, no, it just, it played out in my mind. It was, to me at least, the dialogue was really easy, but I don't know if it's, I feel like it's believable, but I mean, the readers will have to tell me how believable it is.
Well, what kind of relationship do you have with your characters? And I ask this because quite a few fictional writers will say that they consider them like kids and friends and families and stuff like that. So do you actually have that same type of relationship?
Again, you guys are asking really interesting questions, so you got to give me like half a second to think of, to process it. But that's a really interesting one as well, in that I guess I'm a fairly positive person, and I like all my characters. I don't really have a villain. The villain in my book is really the diseases. And if you read through, you'll see that so many of the horror shows, so many of the terrible injuries and stuff are caused by our own stupidity sometimes. And yet I never tried to make any of the characters unlikable. I think because, throughout my career, it didn't matter where the person came from, what their background was, what their culture was. It was important for me to care about them and like them. And I guess that happened with my characters. But But the original book was, I don't know, 260,000 words long. And I realized I wasn't Stephen King and couldn't get away with a book that long. So I, you know, cut it down to 100,000, and several characters, you know, got dropped to the cutting room floor. And I, that was like knocking off some of my children. I had a witch in there who I really loved, and a former pro football player who I really liked. They, you know, that was really tough to let them go.
In a book like this, you know, it's a thriller, it's a mystery sort of medical thriller, ghost thriller and all that. Is there a subtext or a point that you hope people get? Like if someone picks up your book, takes it home, reads it, at the end of it, besides the entertainment value of it, and whether it came out organically or if you planned it, is there some sort of a theme?
Yeah, there's probably too many themes. You know, I'm a novice at the novel side, and therefore I probably are affixing great hopes to this. And in the end, really what I want is a dialogue with readers. I truly enjoy delving into various subjects, and I would love it if readers contacted me and discuss various entities and various subjects with me. Or I always willing to talk to a reading group or large groups. I don't care about any of the subjects, but some of the things, you know, as I said, first of all, I really wanted to give a peek behind the scenes so people really understood what was going on in the brain surgery world and what we could accomplish, what we couldn't accomplish, kind of the toll it was taking on everybody. I really wanted to portray the fragility of life, just how darn easy it was for somebody to go, you know, from being a living, viable being to an inanimate flesh, and therefore really, you know, get across the sense that we ought to be cherishing what we have in life and the loved ones around us. I had that burnout theme in it, and I wanted people to realize that everybody can burn out. It doesn't just have to be the doctors. You know, that we live in a hyper complex world anymore, and the stresses are there for everybody. I wanted really to get across something that I felt every day there, and that was the bravery and the grace of the patients. But not only the patients, half the time my patients were in coma, it's the families going through these horrible situations, and just how darn brave and graceful they were. I always thought, you know, you tell me or you tell me that a family member has a brain tumor, I'd be screaming and throwing chairs and stuff like that. And you know, time after time after time, the people just were amazing. And just, I mean, just inspirational. It's pretty much kind of some of the fuel that allows you to keep going, because you're just stunned by again, the humanity, I guess, of it all. And then I guess I also wanted to play a little with that interface between the hyper-scientific and kind of the more fantastical. Because I one of my favorite sayings of Shakespeare is that there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy, meaning that we're so proud of how much we know and how much we control with science, but we can't even explain human consciousness. We have no idea what happens to us after death, and so I'm totally open for virtually anything. And I thought it'd be interesting to play with that theme, and therefore bringing the ghosts into it. You know, if there are indeed ghosts, it certainly opens up a lot of thoughts about what happens after death. I guess those are some of the things. I could go on probably, but those are a few.
Well, I know, kind of speaking on the same wavelength. I know you go through this more in the book, but can you kind of, I guess, encapsulate what a day in the life is like for a neurosurgeon?
Yeah, in the original writing of it, I put all these vignettes of, you know, big cases and terrible illnesses and terrible car accidents and stuff like that. But they tended to be one-offs vignettes. And one of the first readers said, "Oh, it looks like your life is pretty easy. You just go in and every so often you have to do an operation." I said, whoa, wait a minute. That's not what I wanted to portray. So that I think it's in the second chapter that you get a day in the life of a brain surgeon, but it's busy is the easiest thing I can tell you is it's long. It's busy. It's nothing but multitasking. And people often say, as a brain surgeon, you know, all you have to do, you're just a technician. You just open up the hood, you tinker around a little, and then you go to the links or you go have a long leisurely lunch. And I'm like, I wish that would be a nice life. But I said, do you really think you don't have to talk to patients? And, you know, when you're trying to convince them that you're going to open up their head and operate on it. No, we spend a huge amount of time talking to patients. So anyway, it begins by running into the hospital early in the morning. It's usually, you know, very early in the morning, dark. Usually run around and see a bunch of ICU patients, usually with several members of your team. There's always some fire going, you know, that you have to try to put out. You then drop down, see your first operation patient for the day, reassure them everything's going to be okay. And then usually you go to a computer and start, trying to catch up with your computer work. And then you have to be in the operating room by 7. And as the anesthesia team is putting the patient to sleep, and you're usually getting frustrated because it's taking them too long. And then you eventually get to your operation, and that can go anywhere from 1 to 10 hours. During that time, usually you're left fairly much alone by the outside world, although a bunch of calls will get in if they're thought deemed to be, you know, really important. You're usually teaching a resident or some medical students or some nurses. So like the dialogue in the book, there's a lot of the protagonist just explaining what he's doing in the operation. But then the minute you step out of the operating room, it's like the world can sense it. Your phone starts going, people are grabbing you, and you just get this multitasking of a million questions at once. Usually as you're running around the hospital seeing one patient after another, and usually that'll go on for about an hour, and then you go into your next operation, and you usually will do anywhere from 2 to 4 operations in a day, all the time in between running, talking to patients, talking to families, seeing the latest coma patient. And then eventually sometime in the evening, you say, all right, enough is enough. I got to get out of here. And you leave, and you always leave feeling like there's a lot of work left undone. And that would be a typical day.
Wow.
What about the cocktail lunches and all that?
yeah. I want to be in Germany where you stop and have a couple steins of beer in between. I don't know if it's apocryphal. They talk about, you know, being in the middle of an operation and putting in a bunch of wet sponges, you know, over the wound and stopping and having lunch, including a beer. I don't know if that's true or not, but that definitely wasn't our world. Lunch was usually about 5 minutes long, and you would just kind of inhale it and then run off. And I'm trying not to play a sad violin, you know, accompanied story. It's just the way it was.
Yeah, he had to shoot those martinis down.
Yeah.
no lounging.
I think gum, you know, THC gummies probably would have worked a lot better.
Well, there you have it. Now you know. Did you have to do a lot of research for any of these things, like maybe some of the ghosts that you were writing about or some of the things that were in this? Or was it just all from you?
A lot of it was from me. I did kind of read up a bunch of ghost stories. I read up, about mostly it was more in the psychiatric and psychology world, to make sure I wasn't, you know, stepping way out of bounds, because the big question on the protagonist is he going insane? And so I didn't, or is this a neurological illness? So I didn't want to make it so far-fetched. I guess when I was writing it, one of the problems I had was I wanted to make it very digestible for a non-medical person. And then I kept getting this feeling of, oh my God, what if a neurologist reads this? They're going to say, that's ridiculous. Or if a psychiatrist read it and said, holy Christmas, Simmons, you know, what the heck is that? That's just out of line. Kind of every so often would stop and say, oh, geez, I better check that, you know, this is at least plausible in the psychiatric or neurology world. And I think I kept it there, but they might argue.
Yeah.
And then there's some marital strife that goes on. So I read a bunch of articles on marital strife, but the neurosurgery I had kind of down.
Well, we have your psychiatrist on the line. No. So now in the medical world where you work, was there a large belief in afterlife or ghosts, or was it really a scientific orientated community? Of course it was, but when it comes to, like you were saying, consciousness and stuff and spirit and ghosts and all that stuff, religion, is it a pretty open community to that, or the majority of people very just cut and dry science?
There's kind of two answers to this. Huge part of my world is neuroscience. And so not only am I a neurosurgeon, but I teach neuroscience in medical school and undergrads, both at Virginia Tech now. In the neuroscience world, and you know, when you really drill down to the true neuroscientists, mostly the PhD side of the neuroscientists, I would say there is a good deal of atheism and nihilism about anything. You know, once the neurons stop firing, it's all over.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
At least when you, you know, when you talk to them on a professional level, I still believe that deep down inside, it's like there are no atheists in foxholes. I think deep down inside, there's probably at least a lot of dualists who want to believe, even if they're saying to themselves, yeah, you know, it's all neurons, it's all neurotransmitters, it's all neuroconnectivity. I would imagine there's still quite a lot of people who are like, yeah, but I personally have a soul. I personally have a being aside from my brain. Once you get into the MD or DO side, the doctor's side, I think you have a fair cross section of beliefs there. I don't think they are as hard science as you might think.
Well, there's always that hope, right?
Yeah.
You know, in essence, you don't really want it to be over.
Yeah, I don't want it all to be bleak nothingness. And I it's common now for people to say, there is an afterlife. It's our energy goes into a greater energy of the universe. And I'm like, screw that. No, I still want myself.
Yeah, that's not good enough. Yeah. I can't have martinis like that.
No. Come up with something else, will you?
This is a very important book to you and stuff. And I imagine, so when you go through the process of writing this book, and now that it's published and out and it's all finished, what changes do you think has happened to you in the process of writing this book?
Oh, my wife would tell you that I needed to do it, that it's some sort of, I don't know, exorcism of a lot of demons that got stored up there. And maybe that's why it went to 260,000 at some point. A lot of stuff had to come out. I don't know. I don't know if it's the book or it's, I retired from neurosurgery. That's a story into itself, in that I had a neurological disease myself, ironically, back, my late 30s, but it left some residua that started getting worse. And when I started getting double vision during surgery, I said, well, that may be time to hang up the cleats. So I stopped neurosurgery, and that's when I was able to really dig into the book. I had written pieces of it before. So I don't know if it's both or one or the other, but I'm just far more emotional than I used to be. I used to be pretty hard, unlike my character, who's able to let his emotions out periodically, but I was pretty hard. I could see some pretty darn nasty stuff and then just roll into the next thing. And I think there's a necessity to that because you have to roll into the next operation and not be all shaken up. But it's interesting. I'm much more easily touched now by humanity, by things. I'll find myself crying to a commercial, for God's sake, sometimes. So there's definitely been that transition. I think I feel lighter. I'm less intense. Sometimes my kids, my three kids, say they don't recognize me. There's definitely been a transition. I'm sure the book definitely helped with that.
So it took the nasty bitch out of you.
Possibly. I'm sure there is plenty of that remains.
Did you ever feel any, I don't know, lack of confidence when you went into writing and giving it out to the public, like having it published? Did you always have confidence that you could do it?
Absolutely. absolutely. There's an interesting phenomena, again, a parallel, but most people who interface with neurosurgeons think that we're a bunch of egotists. They think that, our egos are titanic. And I would argue that you do, this is in the book too, I think, but anyway, I would argue that you need some level of ego to go in and do brain surgery and expect it to come out okay. But man, our egos get beaten to shreds. In our specialty, at least, because we have a lot of bad outcomes. The brain, the spinal cord are not very forgiving. And so they are, a lot of times they're injured beyond repair and we're just trying to save them. But, we also inflict some damage. As a matter of fact, it's in the book, but you guys with the mysteries, and I know with your own books, there, Alan, you've looked at serial killers, but I consider us serial killers as well. I read an interesting article in the New Yorker many years ago called Accidental Killers. And it's about people who accidentally killed people, usually with a car accident or something. But, they weren't drinking. There was no guilt or anything involved. But they were wrecked by it. But we in my business, we do kill people. We maim people while trying, obviously, our best to do their best for them. So our egos get beaten. And I would not call us egotists. I would say our egos were always in need of repair. So going into writing, writing nonfiction, I could pretty much stick with nonfiction. And so we're just really making points there. And I've read plenty of poorly written nonfiction books that I was less worried. But writing, fiction, I was like, oh my God, this is bound to fail. But in the end, I wanted to get the story out no matter what. So I guess I just figured I'd take my lumps and let people have at it if they wanted to. I rewrote like crazy. So I think I got it a hell of a lot better than it was. But I'm not ready to be compared with Faulkner or something. So I did not go in with a belief that this was the next Pulitzer Prize winner.
Yeah. My next serial killer book is about you. So
I'm happy to provide you details.
Well, I'm wondering, why do you think there's such a perception of neurosurgeons and egotism? Is it from movies or?
I think the movies certainly help, but I think, again, it's part of the reason why I wrote the book. I wanted to pull back the veil a little bit. I think nobody knows what goes on in there. We all know that the brain you know, is a big deal. And therefore, I mean, we immediately don't, we get immediately associated with rocket scientists, right? And particle physicists and stuff. You know, it's assumed that we must be geniuses if we're operating on the locus of genius, I guess. And so I think there's that. And then I think there's a lot of us who are just freaking burnt out, and the way we're expressing our burnout is by being pricks, by, you know, snapping at people, barking at the nurses, at, you know, just being dismissive of a lot of people, partially because of burnout, partially because we are so time compressed, you know, our days are so compressed by so many different demands being put on us, that we are curt, we are quick, we aren't making a lot of relationships, we're just quickly running through various areas and barking out orders. And so it does get interpreted that, you know, this is just somebody with a titanic ego.
Well, and I would think that it's got to compress. I mean, if you're really time compressed, you've got to have confidence enough to do, and that's still quite a, you know, it's got to be a lot of pressure on you to try and complete a job in something like this, because like you said, the outcome can be very, you know, very hard. It can be very bad. So I would imagine if you didn't have confidence, which appears to be ego, then maybe that's maybe what people also see.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you get, I would, so many of this darn stuff you'd bring home too. But part of what was going on is you were being asked for a decision every few minutes, sometimes every few seconds. And these decisions, they had real life impact on each of these patients that they were being made for. But the residents would run up to you and say, "Mr. Jones just did this." And you would just say, "Okay, do that." And then the PAs would come up and say, "This person's doing this." And you say, "Oh, okay, do that." And you're always making these quick, decisions and sorting things out. And it was just going on nonstop. So I would get home. And, you know, my wife would start telling me something and you would just bark out, "Okay, well, you just, you know, call the plumber," you know, you just make these split second decisions on everything that was presented to you at home. And for anybody, you know, when I did all my studying on relations, because I didn't understand this until I did, you know, I've been told that when your spouse wants to tell you about their day, they're not really looking for you to give decisions and commands immediately. Sometimes they just want you to listen. That's something I guess I never really understood. That was funny. The other thing that my wife would always tell me is we'd be at the dinner table and, you know, you're taught in neurosurgery never to look away from the wound. And again, this probably feeds into the whole thing, but so what you do is you ask for your next instrument. You say, "Give me a Roentgen 9. And you would reach your hand out and it would be put into your hand. And the idea, the reason for that is not for you to be impolite. It's for you to never take your eyes off the field and lose your place, if you will. And so I would get home and have dinner and, you know, I'd be, "Please pass the salt." And I would reach out my hand and expect the salt to be slapped into it.
Knife, fork,
exactly. So I, you know, all these things I think probably fed into
it. So what's your intention here now? Do you plan on writing a series like this or following through and keeping the same Ryan character or not?
Well, you know, there's a whole nother novel and a half sitting there on the cutting room floor with witches and pro football players. So I may use that. We'll see where that goes. I'll see what the response is. I actually have a YA novel that's written, but it's in about the 10th rewrite right now. Originally, my plan was I have three boys and I am a little frightened of the future of the world, of what's happening with males in the world, because women are kind of kicking our butts scholastically. And, you know, you look in my neuroscience classes and it's 80% women, and there's nothing wrong with that. I salute it and all. But I worry about idle men. Idle men are dangerous. And so in this grand, I'm going to save the world. I thought, maybe I should write, you know, really engrossing YA novels for that hopefully would attract men, boys to read. So, you know, it's a sports novel with a lot of sports and some cars and, you know, a little dabble of romance, but more sports. And that one's almost done. And I was, you know, each one was kind of going to be based around one of my sons. So I've got those. And I've got a post-apocalyptic type novel that's, I've got a few chapters into that's kind of politically oriented. So, we'll see what I do with that one. So I don't know. Long story short, I don't know. Definitely we'll finish up the YA novel next and then go from there.
Yeah, your YA is pretty popular and, you know, politics, it's dangerous, but it's popular.
Yeah, I found out on Twitter how dangerous it is.
Yeah, you have to be careful. I mean, it's a strange world now. And you just have to be really careful because especially trying to put a product out or sell a book or something like that, you say the wrong thing about the wrong person, all of a sudden you're in the book bin.
Yeah, I know. I'm afraid it was easy to get sucked into some of the other, you know, I started putting things in about the book and maybe one person looked at it. And if I mentioned something political, you know, 1,000 people did and they're all yelling at me. So, attention, good advertising or something? I don't know.
Yeah, in a sense it is because, I'll do that and get myself into trouble once in a while, but it's sort of a good thing because a lot of people are brought to your attention, so to speak. I don't think it's a bad thing. And I think the U.S. and a lot of the world just has to get over this whole thing, you know. You like who you like and you don't like who you like, you know. It's craziness, you know. Someone say, if anybody mentions Trump one way or the other, you've got this backlash. And it's kind of like, well, it's crazy. Why can't you just like and dislike what you like and dislike, you know?
Yeah, I mean, go back to the old, can't we all just get along? I mean,
I don't
get it.
Yeah,
it's frightening, actually, you know, just at how we're at each other's throats right now. Hopefully we can de-escalate it at some point here. Right now, it's easy to blame, you know, you guys, the Canadians. You're trying
yeah.
to smoke
yes.
us out.
No, that's what, you know, that's why we're doing it. We're taking away the attention from drag queens reading in the library and Donald Trump and indictments and all the other stuff. So we're blowing smoke your way, and then you'll turn around and you'll forget everything.
Well, you're literally blowing the smoke, and so we appreciate it. I did want to make one other point for you, though, seeing you guys are, you know, your main focus is mystery, right?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think that originally it was, but then, you know, over the years, we've branched out so many ways now.
Well, I was just thinking, though, that you know, you think of almost every detective character in mystery novels, and I would argue that they're all burned out. It's, you know, burnout is rife. It's 95% in novel detectives.
Oh, yeah. They all need to be put down.
I think they all need some work on wellness and some meditation and that sort of thing.
Oh, there's not too many of those detectives that would do that.
Well, that's what they say about neurosurgeons, you see.
Well, you know, I've heard stories, you know. So listen, now, have you got social media set up? Have you got a website? Have you got... how do people get a hold of Gary?
I am a total novice. So, of course, I bought all sorts of books on how I'm supposed to do this. So I did set up a website. It's GaryRSimmons.com. Pretty easy. S-I-M-O-N-D-S. No two M's. And there is a D in there. It's kind of spelled like Simons. Gary R. Simmons. GaryRSimmons.com. And it's got the fundamentals. I kind of built it myself, and that will become very evident. But it does have ways to get in touch with me, which to me is the most important thing. I really I really want out of this book. I would love it if people read it. I don't need to become rich from it, but I would like people to read it for sure. And what I really want them to do is think about some of the issues raised and have at it with me, you know, if they disagree or agree, and have discussions about it. And I would discuss it with, you know, any size group. But I also did all the other things I'm supposed to do. I did get on Twitter and then got nose deep in politics. I do have the Facebook thing. I don't quite understand the author's side of Facebook. I have an author's page there, but I don't really know how to use that. I have the Amazon and the multiple other, you know, book related places where I do have my pages. So I'm trying to figure out how to use all the main desire is just to connect with
people. We'll get you on TikTok here. How's that?
I am on TikTok. And I started making videos because one of the hats I wear is I'm advising people advising pre-meds on how to get into medical school. So I started making little TikTok videos of that. So I'm even on TikTok.
That's exciting.
I keep telling my students I'm jiggy with it. And they don't seem to understand.
They don't know what that is. That's 30 years old.
They give me like I have two heads.
Of course, now we're going to have all that up on the website and everything will be good so people can find it with one click. And they don't have to worry about the spelling, you know. What can I say?
That's amazing.
Well, how was pandemic for you? How was this writing during the pandemic? I would imagine you had to write over some of that time to get this book out.
Yes, I love the pandemic. I wish we had more of them. Every minute of it was a dream come true. No. We had the pandemic hit just after I retired from clinical neurosurgery, you know, from doing the operations. Like I said, I keep teaching, but we moved from Roanoke, Virginia, where Virginia Tech and all that is. We moved down to Black Mountain, North Carolina. I don't know if you know the area. But it's near Asheville, North Carolina, in the mountains of North Carolina. Very, just a gorgeous place. And we loved the town. And we became regulars in a couple of the bars because they have a lot of good music here. It's just a great place for music. And I play the banjo and the guitar. And I'm going to learn the bagpipes soon if they keep using the leaf blowers around me. So we were really getting into the town and we could walk in the town and all that sort of thing. And then COVID hit. And so all that stuff got shut down, which actually made it easier to write. So I had to finish up my third burnout book, a nonfiction book. So I spent some of the time doing that. And I really, again, I really was working on the YA novel. And then it just, this book became a compulsion. And that's when it really inflated and, you know, I just kept writing and then rewriting. And, you know, all we could do other than that was take the dog for a walk, but even he was getting bored, you know, with the walks. So it really, it actually made it pretty easy to do a lot of compulsive writing.
Well, I think it's better. We don't need to be communicating with each other or seeing each other. Humans are terrible. Dogs are better. But as a doctor and science-orientated person, did sort of the behavior of a lot of people, and we don't even have to touch politics, but did the behavior of a lot of people, you know, anti-vax or there's no such thing as COVID and not wearing a mask and all that, did that sort of behavior surprise you?
Yeah, I mean, yes, in a word, disappoint might be more, disgust might even be another term for it. But I at least got to see the flip side. You know, I certainly have just a million friends in the medical world. I actually volunteered to go back at a couple of places. But funnily enough, they didn't want a surgeon who was seeing double going back to surgery. But there was, you know, there was a lot of dedication, a lot of bravery, because it was brave for people at that point. When it started, we had no idea. We had no idea if we were going to end up dead. And in my world, in my, you know, communicate on our emails, a couple of people that we knew well died of COVID. And so, you know, the initial thought was, we just had no idea how much you were wading into harm's way by going into the hospital every day. Yet everybody did it, and they did it, you know, without much pushback. So I got to see that side a lot. And then, you know, the fact that they came up with a vaccine in a year just blew me away. Again, talk about heroic efforts. I just was stunned, because I was telling my non-medical friends, it's going to be years. It's going to be years before we have anything, because that's the way it used to work. So there were huge positives. And then when we kind of got these waves of, you know, deniers of this and that, it was very disappointing. I think the messaging left a lot to be desired, both on, you know, the political level, but really the CDC and all, it seemed to lack quite a bit. And part of it was an admission of, hey, we don't know everything. This is brand new, guys. We don't know everything. We're not going to know everything right away. We are going to make wrong assumptions, and that's just the way it's going to be. I think if we had a little bit more of that, it may have been accepted better in the first place.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I'm sure.
It then fell in with all the other political craziness that's been going on. So
it's all your fault.
I do blame myself.
You started it.
Well, it's that inner voice I told you about that blames me for basically anything.
Well, yeah, there we go. Now we know. We've learned a lot. Not only are you a writer, but you caused all the problems we have right now, even the smoke.
I did work in the NIH for a year way back when, so that may have been the dabbling there with all those rats.
I knew it. There was something. Stop eating them. Well, anyway.
Well, it's been a pleasure. So now, of course, the book is called Death's Pale Flag.
And yes.
It's written by our guest, Mr. Gary Simmons. So thank you for being on the show.
It's my absolute delight. Your questions were fantastic.
Thanks, Gary.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.